30. Closing argument. Walter Hudson. Pursuing happiness thoughtfully. 8 to 10 weeknights on Twin Cities News Talk. AM 1130 and 103.5 FM.
I don't know about you guys, but cabin fever has set in for me pretty definitively. Like, I'm ready to just go outside at the first sign of any sort of warmth. And, you know, I'm old enough now to have established a pattern. I know exactly how this is going to go. As soon as the warmth does come and the snow starts to melt a little bit, I'm going to rush out there within the course of like a 2-week span, do everything that I've been, that I always say I want to do when it's warm outside. And then for the entire rest of the season, spring, summer, and fall, I'm just going to stay in my house. In the great irony. And not feel cabin fever at all, because I'll at least have the option. It's really about having the option to go outside. That's really what it's about. It's not about, you know, I actually want to go out there for any length of time. I just want it to be something that is a possibility. And right now it very much feels like it's not, especially with the pending snow and cold that is upon us this weekend. By the way, this weekend for this program starts at the close of the show this evening. We've got your Gophers hockey tomorrow night, and so we will not be live. There'll be potentially some replay segments after the game is over tomorrow night. So I'm going to treat tonight like a Freestyle Friday, even though it's a Thursday. So if you want to take the show in any direction, if you want to bring up a topic we talked about earlier in the week, you want to bring up a totally random topic, feel free to do so. 651-989-5855, the number to join us on Closing Argument. My name's Walter Hudson. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. Streaming at TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com and your iHeartRadio app. We are here 8 to 10 weeknights. Appreciate you joining us. Brianne, producing the show, taking those calls for the, I've been saying vacationing, Brad. In point of fact, he's engaged in his responsibilities as a member of the armed forces. He's overseas and engaged in some training, as I understand it. Hopefully having a little bit of fun in there.
I think he is. I've seen the Instagram posts.
Yeah, okay. I've not been tracking his social media, but there was definitely some discussion as to whether or not he was going to be allowed to go off base and do anything while he was over there. And so hopefully that did happen, because it would be a shame to travel that far, be gone for 3 weeks, and never get to do anything fun. So hopefully he'll have some stories to tell us off air when he comes back. All right, let's get right into it tonight. So you heard at the top of the hour news that there have been some legislative hearings which took place today regarding gun control legislation in St. Paul. And we have on the line with us Rob Doerr, who is the president, I believe, of the Minnesota Gun Owners Caucus.
Political director.
Political director. There
we go. I'll take the promotion.
Yeah, I was just going to pull a title out of my hat and hope it stuck, you know, so yeah. I probably had like a 30% chance. Gunowners.mn is the website where you can find out more about their organization. And I guess my first question for you, Rob, first of all, thanks for coming on the show tonight.
Yeah, anytime. I love listening to your show on the way back from the Capitol, so I'm glad you're on in the evening.
Well, we're glad to be here. My first question for you is, I'm sure you caught that top of the hour news. Were you present at these legislative hearings, and what's your perspective on what took place today?
Yeah, they started off last night at 7 and went until midnight, and they still didn't get through them all, so they finished them up this afternoon during the regularly scheduled committee sessions. But yeah, I'm down there every day during the legislative session, and I'm in every single public safety committee meeting. And, we had our slate of testifiers who presented the opposition testimony to the bill, or both bills, actually.
So what was the feel in the room? You know, I get the sense that typically these types of things tend to be pretty lopsided in favor of those who are seeking to further erode our rights. Was that the case, or was there a pretty 50-50 representation?
Well, the lead up to the committee hearings was pretty interesting. Of course, with the Democrats being in control of the House and Carlos Mariani, who's certainly no friend to gun owners, at the helm of the Public Safety Committee, we expected kind of a recipe for disaster. The first thing that they tried to do is they tried to schedule the committee hearings at Edina Middle School.
Yeah, I heard about that. So that didn't happen.
And what we got from Edina Middle School is that Representative Edelson, who's the vice chair of the committee, new representative out of Edina, She had called and told the school officials that they wanted to do a school safety conversation. Not a public hearing for the Minnesota House, but a school safety conversation.
Uh-huh.
What we did is in Minnesota statute, we've got the ability as permit to carry holders to request the permission from the principal or the superintendent of the schools to carry.
Right.
So we drafted up a template that our members could use. And our members sent over 1,000 requests for the right to carry. And Edina kind of said, whoa, this isn't what we expected on this conversation on school safety.
Right.
And they backed out. And then they tried Hopkins Middle School or Hopkins High School.
Uh-huh.
And they announced that Saturday during our rally. And between Saturday at noon and 5 p.m., our members sent over 800 requests to Hopkins High School. And they also pulled out.
Do you have any sense, and I know, you know, you might have suspicions that you don't necessarily want to articulate, but is there any substantiation as to what the rationalization or justification is for having a legislative hearing anywhere other than the state capitol when there's no, it's not as though, you know, we've had some construction that's taken place at the capitol over the past couple of years, and I can understand if hearing rooms are scarce and things are under construction, there's just not access to space, but that's not the case. Why did the DFL want to have these hearings away from their typical form?
Well, Carlos Mariani, the chair representative, he was very clear. He wanted he gave multiple reasons. In committee, he said he wanted to have it there so that we could all be mindful of who they're trying to save, and that they wanted to make it easier for students and parents to have a voice in the process.
They can't. What? Okay, so students and parents who go to that particular school, or
right, and it, for those of you keeping track at home, Edina is kind of gun control central in Minnesota. That's where a lot of the Moms Demand Action activists actually live. You know,
right.
Hopkins not being too far away, but I think the bigger point is, you know, the Capitol, as you pointed out, is where laws are made.
Right,
they've got live streaming available for anybody who can't be there. They can you know, watch at home.
Right.
There's the Green Line, which runs right by the Capitol in order to give people easy transportation. But most of all, we've invested over $100 million in Capitol security, and there's the
Correct.
Staff who have trained in that building to keep everybody safe.
Right.
But also, citizens have the full capability to exercise all of their rights there,
right.
with the schools, of course, being a gun-free zone.
Yeah, well, and this kind of goes hand in hand with something else I heard that perhaps you can provide more insight on, which is the notion that there have been... changes in, I don't know if they were ever actually written rules or just rules of thumb in terms of the type of conduct that's allowed in these legislative hearings, where previously it's been banned for people to hold signs or to engage in any sort of political demonstration inside of a legislative hearing. And as of recently, as soon as the DFL took control, they basically changed the rules and said it's okay for you to hold up pictures of loved ones who have been the victims of gun violence. And that kind of goes hand in hand with this notion of, well, we're gonna come out of the Capitol, we're gonna go to a school, and we're gonna engage in this political theater around this issue. Since when did a legislative hearing become a platform for political theater? I thought we were supposed to have dispassionate. The whole concept of a hearing is we're going to consider facts and consider arguments and engage in a dispassionate deliberation of what public policy ought to be.
Yeah, wouldn't that be grand? And you're absolutely right. The rules say in both the House and the Senate that there's no props, there's no signs, there's no demonstrations. And they've given wide latitude to people holding up photos. And, you know, it's kind of one of those things. It's who wants to tell the person that they can't hold up a photo of their loved one. But I mean, they've taken it to some extremes where, you know, anti-gun activists are holding up photos of gruesome crime scenes and things like
right.
that. And I think that's a little bit too wide latitude that the chairs have discretion over.
Well, and I mean, we wouldn't have to look too far to see examples of the hypocrisy. If, for instance, there was some sort of hearing, which, you know, probably won't happen in the current political climate here in the state, but if there was some sort of hearing regarding a law having to do with abortion or some issue along those lines, and you had pro-life people who were wanted to hold up signs of fetuses that had gone through that procedure in gruesome fashion, you can bet that they'd be calling the bailiffs to haul those people out in dramatic fashion.
Yeah, and one thing I appreciate about you, Walter, is you're very intellectually honest. You think what's good for the goose is good for the gander, and, right. And I'm inclined to agree along those lines.
So let me try to, as best as I can, and it is a stretch for me, try to play devil's advocate a little bit on some of the legislation that the DFL is trying to put forward here. So, for instance, when we take a look at universal background checks, which I believe is one of the bills that they were considering over the last couple of days, the sense is, or at least the narrative we're told in the media, is that there's broad bipartisan consensus that this is just common sense. We ought to have universal background checks. So what's the big deal? Why is it? Why should we resist the notion that if you're going to transfer a firearm from one person to another, the person who's receiving it ought to undergo some sort of government background check?
You know, for us is when you're exercising a constitutionally protected right, you should have the ability to determine the type of commerce that you engage in. So if you want to go to a federally licensed dealer and fill out the paperwork and register yourself as a gun owner that way, you can do that. If you wanted to instead buy a firearm from your friend, you should be able to do that. But the bigger thing is, we know that this isn't how criminals acquire their firearms.
Right.
When you look at the data, the largest section of criminally acquired firearms are from straw purchases. So this holy background check, which is supposed to solve everything, is being done in 63% of the cases, just not on the person who's actually receiving the firearm. But beyond that, these bills, they keep saying sales. They say sales, sales, sales. Even your newser at the top of the hour said sales. They are talking about transfers.
Right.
Now, Walter, if I wanted to take you hunting during deer season and you didn't have a deer rifle and I was to hand you a deer rifle for the weekend to go hunting, that's a transfer.
Yep.
And under these bills that are proposed, we would need to go to a federally licensed dealer, pay a fee so that I could hand the gun over to you. Now, when you're done hunting, do you think you can just hand that gun back to me?
You would think so.
No, we have to go back to the dealer, pay another fee, register the transaction so that I can get my own property back. So we're adding all of these extraneous hurdles that law-abiding citizens will jump through because they want to remain law-abiding citizens.
Correct.
The criminals are just going to keep whistling Dixie and laughing at us as they do everything that they've been doing the whole time.
The last bill that I want to talk to you about here while we have you here tonight is the red flag gun law. Now, my understanding of this, and going back to the immediate aftermath of the Parkland shooting, you know, I was one of these people who was saying, and there were other conservatives, I believe Ben Shapiro was one of them as well, who was saying that it does make sense to have some process by which a due process by which you can take into consideration evidence that a particular person is irresponsible and should not have access to a firearm due to some sort of mental instability or demonstrated threatening behavior or something along those lines. And here we have these red flag gun laws that are being proposed that ostensibly provide for that, for a judge to determine that a particular individual, not a whole class of people, but a particular individual is a danger to themselves and others and therefore should not be able to have a firearm. What's wrong with that?
So, yeah, you know, for me, yeah, I look at it that if somebody is too dangerous to own a firearm, then there's something greater at risk there, and we need to address the person in crisis and not think that that taking the firearms away somehow alleviates the issue. And there are provisions right now in Minnesota statute that allow family members, law enforcement to petition the courts to remove firearms, but it's done with the person having the ability to offer their side of the story. And there's civil commitment processes as well, which also would remove somebody's ability to own firearms. But the biggest egregious part of these bills that they're putting in is this ex parte process. And the ex parte process allows law enforcement or a family member to petition the courts to remove your firearms without you actually being present to offer your defense.
Yeah.
So with a mere preponderance of the evidence, that's 50% in a thumbnail, they can go, and with just one side of the story, mind you,
right,
the judge can issue an order. And I tell you, what judge wants to get this wrong? Which judge right. isn't right. going to sign this right. order? And with those orders, can go and order your firearm seized without you even knowing an accusation has been levied against you, much less being able to provide a defense of the accusations against you.
Well, and that's the truly insidious nature of this, is that, you know, when folks such as myself and Shapiro and whoever else was saying, yeah, this sounds reasonable to have a process by which we take a look at evidence against a particular person and determine whether or not they ought to have a gun, implicit in that is actual due process, whereby there's a presumption of innocence and the evidence has to meet a standard higher than just preponderance, and it's modeled after a criminal proceeding, and the left seems to have seized upon that notion and run with it as far as they possibly can to basically just create a scenario where it's tag, you don't get to have guns now.
Right, and I think the big piece missing out of this is the what are we doing about the person?
Right,
right now in Minnesota we've got 72-hour holds. If somebody poses a significant risk to themselves or to somebody else, officers or a family member can place them on a 72-hour hold, which they get held for medical evaluation, and then they can come up with a care plan or release the person. Maybe it was just a bad day at work. Maybe they said something they regretted. At least you're addressing the person in crisis. And likewise, with our domestic violence statutes, which was talked a lot about last night, officers are directed, if they believe domestic violence has occurred within the last 72 hours or is imminent, that they have to make an arrest. They can't issue a citation. They can't issue a summons. They have to make an arrest. But with both of those scenarios, as well as with the other laws about civil commitment and things like that, you're actually addressing the person in crisis. You're not taking their firearms away and saying, bye, have a nice day,
right,
while you leave all the medicine in the medicine cabinet, knives right. in the kitchen drawer. Yeah.
Rob Dorr, political director of the Minnesota Gun Owners Caucus, appreciate you taking out some time for us here tonight, and also spending your time down there at the Capitol. Very much appreciate the work you're doing.
Thanks, guys. I appreciate it.
Have a good one. Gunowners.mn is the website. Check them out. See how you can help. My name is Walter Hudson. Closing argument, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, Twin Cities News Talk,
3.5 FM.
When I was preparing for our conversation with Rob Dorr, the political director of Minnesota Gun Owners Caucus, I came across an article from the Foundation for Economic Education that describes, you know, because we hear constantly whenever this topic of gun violence and the need for common sense gun control legislation arises, we constantly hear stated as clear and present fact, completely unchallenged and beyond any sort of scrutiny, that the United States of America is unique in the world as the worst place on earth for gun violence. We're number one when it comes to mass shootings and gun violence. Well, turns out that's not true at all. Not by a long shot. Closing argument, my name is Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. You can join us tonight at 651-989-5855, and we would love to have you, Breanne, taking those calls. Statistics on global mass shooting incidents from 2009 to 2015, compiled by economist John Lott of the Crime Prevention Research Center, show that the U.S. trails many other advanced nations in mass shooting frequency and death rate. Death rate per million people for mass shootings from 2009 to 2015, the United States is number three, no, five, seventh, nope, ninth, not even, 11th, yes, number 11. Let me list off, it's worth listing the countries that come before us that are worse when it comes to mass shooting, all right, because it's not even places like the Middle East. Like, it's not even places you would expect. Number one on the list, by a long shot, way out in front, Norway. That socialist bastion that we're constantly pointed to as, oh, we should be more like them. They're so enlightened. We should follow their lead. Way out in front, Norway. followed by Serbia. Then number three, Vive la France, the French. Number three on this list. Macedonia is number four, Albania, five, Slovakia, six, Switzerland comes in at number seven, still several steps above us, then Finland, then Belgium, and right before us is the Czech Republic. The Czech Republic, which is about 50% more than us in terms of deaths per million people from mass shootings between the years of 2009 and 2015. So there's your fact. So the next time you hear in the media, you hear somebody say, oh, this kind of thing happened, or you see that onion story that gets posted after every mass shooting. Every time there's a mass shooting, they recycle the same onion story about how, you know, politicians come out and say they have no idea how this keeps happening in this country. So say the people where this happens all the time, the most, more than any other country on earth. Not true. Fake news. Fake as it gets. Frequency of mass public shootings. There is another list here, and we come in number 12th on that one. And all the same countries listed before also rank above us there. An Investor Business Daily noted on these findings, yes, the U.S. rate is still high and nothing to be proud of, but it's not the highest in the developed world, not by a long shot. So something to keep in mind when you're engaged in your impromptu debates with folks around the water cooler regarding gun control. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com.
And 103.5 FM.
It's a long day living in Reseda. There's a freeway running through the yard.
It's been a couple of days since we had our conversation, our two-hour-long discussion with Pastor Nathan Roberts and Lori Egan, who is a registered nurse working in reproductive health, regarding abortion. And I wanted to give that conversation some space, give myself some time to kind of decompress from the experience before reflecting upon it. But I think some reflection is in order. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. Streaming at TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com and your iHeartRadio app. We are here 8 to 10 weeknights. Appreciate you joining us. You can contribute to the program. 651-989-5855 is the number to do so. Brianne taking those calls and producing the show this evening. From the Daily Wire, a mid-February poll found that for the first time in 10 years, the percentage of Americans who were pro-life had risen to tie the percentage of Americans who were pro-choice. The results of the Morris poll, which is sponsored and funded in partnership with the Knights of Columbus, showed a stunning show of growth for the pro-life movement, as a January Morris poll found pro-choicers with a huge edge, 55% to 38%. That's pretty remarkable that it went from 38 to as high as it did. So there is movement on this issue, and I would tend to attribute that to the extreme positions that have been taken as of late in states such as New York and Virginia and Vermont, and the theater we just saw in Washington, D.C. with the Democrats opposing a bill that would have required medical care to be provided for babies who are born from botched abortions, who are alive. They oppose that, which just pause and think about this. How could you possibly oppose that? On what basis could you possibly say that a baby that has been born and is no longer in the womb should not receive medical care? And this from the party who's constantly accusing us of not caring about people. It's absolutely astounding. Matt Walsh had some things to say about this. He said the legislation would not restrict abortion at all. It had nothing to do with reproductive rights or choice or fetuses or any handy euphemism. The point was simply to protect those children who are born after a failed abortion. Let me emphasize, the bill in question would have given legal protection to born, living, infant humans. Under the law, had it passed, hospitals would have been required to deliver basic medical care to these children. Now, just, you know, to pause for a moment to acknowledge an esoteric libertarian point here. There's one argument against this that I could stomach. And that's the notion that the law should never compel anybody to serve anyone, right? Like the whole notion that You should not be compelled under the law to provide your services to someone else under any circumstances because you are not their slave. However, in order for that argument to hold any kind of water in this context, we would first have to be in a society where we've adopted that premise, and we obviously are not. We live in a context where hospitals are, as of this moment, currently required to provide care for whoever shows up to their doorstep. And the fact that a born, living, infant human, as Matt Walsh puts it at the Daily Wire, does not qualify for that is an indictment of our culture and an indictment of the status quo. Walsh continues, criminal penalties were also prescribed for anyone who kills a born infant. It is quite a sad statement that such a law would even need to be proposed in the first place, but that's the state of things, with Democrats in Virginia proposing infanticide and Democratic legislators across the country pushing the boundaries of abortion legalization further and further toward the point of birth. It became necessary to build a legislative wall protecting, at the very least, any child who manages to escape the gauntlet of the modern womb. Yet Democrats, who are famously opposed to walls, would not support this one either. With one vote last night, the Democratic Party finally and officially endorsed infanticide. We have come, plummeted is probably the better word, a long way since 2002 when the Born Alive Infant Protection Act passed unanimously through the Senate. That bill recognized all born children as human persons, which is a position that has since fallen out of favor in the Democratic Party. In just over a decade and a half, Democrats have gone from safe, legal, and rare abortions to kill them all and don't stop when they're born. Many of us warned that the first slogan would lead eventually to the second. We take no pleasure in our vindication. But the question of how we arrived at this point is academic. The most immediate and practical point is that we are now at a place where every Democrat in the Senate, save three holdouts, supports fourth trimester abortion. The Democrat Party has been for a long while and is now inescapably an evil institution. A decent person cannot in good conscience remain affiliated with it. That isn't to say that every decent person must be a Republican. The Republican Party, after all, is hardly a bastion of moral courage, but a person with any sort of moral foundation, a person with any ethical sense whatsoever, cannot and will not align himself with a political institution that passionately defends abortion through every stage of pregnancy and beyond. That, again, from Matt Walsh, writing at the Daily Wire. And considering these two pieces back-to-back, the news that there's this shift that has taken place, albeit potentially, however, temporary, in favor of the pro-life position, and this observation or analysis from Matt Walsh regarding the vote that was taken place in Washington, D.C. regarding the preservation of life for those infants who survive botched abortions. It provided me cause, as I was preparing for the show tonight, to reflect on a conversation we had with Pastor Nathan Roberts and Lori Egan regarding abortion on Tuesday of this week. And you can go back, you can go to your iHeartRadio app and listen to that if you missed it. It was titled The Abortion Debate. And, you know, I have some follow-up thoughts that I'd like to share with you. So at the outset, I raised the question of, you know, I tried to establish a common ground. And the common ground that I tried to establish was pretty simple. I asked the question, you know, can we at least agree that what we're talking about is the end of a life? And it turns out we could not agree on that point. What was offered in response was this curious notion that the medical community defines life as being beginning at, quote, viability, and that viability occurs at somewhere like 20 to 24 weeks. Now, you know, I myself am not a doctor. I have no medical education, and I haven't done any research on this point. But it does strike me as odd that the medical definition of life would have any connection whatsoever with this concept of viability. Because the notion of viability is entirely arbitrary, right? Like, does the capacity to survive outside the womb have to do with the definition of life as such? So are you telling me that before that 20 to 24 week point, the object in question, the embryo, the fetus, is something other than a living organism? It's not alive? And if you do concede that it is alive in some sense, Are you arguing that it's not human, that it's something other than human, that it's some sort of vestigial organ of the mother, that it's not a distinct organism? And by what science, by what medicine are you arguing that? And, you know, that's not a path that we went down on Tuesday because, you know, I didn't feel as though we were going to make a whole lot of headway on it, but it is a ringing sticking point in my mind coming out of that conversation. Continually asserted on Tuesday night was the notion that we should strive for zero abortions. This was something that Nathan said a number of times, and I kept asking him, well, why? Why should we strive for a world where there are zero abortions if there's nothing wrong with having an abortion, right? If abortions are okay, if abortions are not morally repugnant and not something that are wrong to engage, like, any other activity or action that a person could take, If it's a bad thing for them to do, I wouldn't say that we should, or if it's a good thing for them to do, I wouldn't say that we should strive for a world where there are zero instances of that activity, right? Like you seem to be acknowledging by saying we should have zero abortions that abortions are wrong to some extent for some reason. So what's the reason? And that's an angle that we weren't really able to dive into too deeply. Every argument seemed to keep coming back to the burden on the mother. The burden on the mother. It's such a hardship for single mothers in particular to have to take on this responsibility of parenthood. And you know, there's economic inequities that are the results of the patriarchy and capitalism and all that's evil with the world. White male, you know, straight Christians have created a world in where it's very difficult for women of color to make ends meet, and therefore they ought to be able to kill their children. And, you know, look, I'm not going to dispute that responsibility is hard. I'm not going to dispute that parenthood is difficult. But welcome to life, right? Like this notion that because a responsibility is difficult, I get to be exempted from it, is a concept that we do not embrace in any other area of life. Indeed, no argument in favor of abortion would ever be accepted in favor of ending human life at any other stage of development. If I were to say that my 2-year-old child is just too much for me to handle, that I can't take it, that I've changed my mind, that I can't do this for another 16 years minimum. I can't afford it. It's too much stress, and society hasn't given me enough in order to enable me to handle this burden without seriously curtailing the enjoyment of my own life. Therefore, I'm going to kill my 2-year-old child. I would go to jail, and nobody would argue it. Well, today they wouldn't. Perhaps we're going to get to that point. Perhaps we're, you know, 10, 15 years away from the point where we actually are debating whether or not you can kill your 2-year-old. Because that certainly seems to be the trajectory of the conversation at this point. But as of now, as of today, I think it's fair to say that we all understand that you can't cite the difficulty of parenthood as an excuse for murder. So it comes back to the question of, what is it that we're even talking about? Are we talking about a human being or not? And, you know, finally, in response to the conversation we had on Tuesday, I want to address the last point that Nathan and Lori raised, which was that, you know, they appealed to the fact that, I think they said 1 out of 4 women between a certain age range have had an abortion. And their point was that in all likelihood, you know somebody who's had one. And so you should really think about that. You should think about the women in your life and the potential that, in fact, somebody you care about has had an abortion, and that should affect your thinking on the issue in terms of how you talk about it and how you think about it. Now, I'll be frank with you. I'll be as frank as it's appropriate for me to be. I do know women in my life who I care about, who I'm close with, who have had abortions. That fact has no bearing whatsoever on my consideration of the morality of abortion. Why would it? How does this work? Somebody needs to explain to me how this argument of, well, you might know somebody who's done it, is supposed to affect your moral calculation of whether or not it's a good thing. Now, I'll grant you this, okay? Do we need to continue to love people who have engaged in activities that we disagree with? Yes. Do we need to be loving in our relationships? Yes, we do. But being loving, you know, as any parent will tell you, and perhaps you need to be a parent, perhaps that's the problem, is you actually need to get to the point where you've been a parent in order to learn this lesson, perhaps. As any parent will tell you, loving somebody does not mean condoning everything they do. Quite the contrary. In fact, more often than not, way more often than not, loving somebody means putting a stake in the ground and saying, this is wrong. What you are doing is wrong. And because I love you, I am calling you out on it. Because I love you, I am going to tell you that is wrong, and I'm going to stick by my guns because it objectively is. And because you are harming yourself. And because I do care about you, and in this case, I care about your unborn child, I'm not going to hold back from my condemnation because you need to hear it. 651-989-5855. Closing argument. My name's Walter Atson. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com.
3.5 FM.
All right, let's try to close out this hour with a couple of calls. 651-989-5855, the number to join us. My name's Walter Hudson. Closing argument, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. We're reflecting upon the conversation we had on Tuesday of this week with Pastor Nathan Roberts and Nurse Lori Egan regarding abortion. Let's start with Al in Edina. Welcome to the show.
Hi. One of the things in this discussion about babies being born even after a failed abortion, being born alive. I guess I wonder where in the spectrum do they normally land? Do they land closer to a vegetable or do they land closer to a Gerber baby? And if it is closer to a vegetable, there's going to be probably going to be a lot of cost and effort required to keep it alive. And who's going to bear that cost?
Do you think that type of consideration played into the opposition to this bill?
I don't know. The thing is that information isn't out there. So who knows where that... See, I don't know how it turns out when a failed abortion happens. What is the result of that?
Well, I mean, there are grown adults walking around today who are the results of that. And some of them were present in Washington, D.C. as this bill was being deliberated and voted upon. And listen, you know, I'll grant you this. The common sense consideration of extenuating circumstance, of course, ought to be allowed for under the law. The idea that we're going to under force of law, compel somebody to expend resources on a hopeless case in order to satisfy some sort of pro-life whim is not something that I believe anybody is suggesting. But I don't think that's really where the debate is resting here. I appreciate the call, Al. I think the debate has very little to do with the kind of nuance that Al is bringing to the conversation and a lot more to do with taking a hard line against any sort of consideration of infant life, frankly, infant life at this point. You can't even say unborn anymore. It includes infant as well as human life, human beings who have personhood and are deserving of protection and deserving of rights. Let's talk to Cindy in Minneapolis. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Walter. I really enjoy your show. You really give a voice to topics that are near and dear to my heart. And I love that it's Freestyle Friday, Thursday. I listened to your podcast on the abortion debate twice, and the thing that kept coming back to me, and you even spoke about it a little bit ago, was when Nathan and Lori were talking about how there just isn't a lot of, we need more support. We
right.
need the, you know, the mothers just don't have the resources, or so it's going to be a hardship.
Right.
Here in Minnesota, we have so many resources
yeah.
that it just seems insane that that's even a problem.
Right.
And when did it become a discrimination that if a child were to be born to a mother that didn't have financial means, that it was okay that their life be ended?
Right. Well, yeah, and that's just it. I appreciate the call, Cindy. And you know, like I was saying before, this is not logic that we would apply to the termination of a human life in any other circumstance. And that's really what it keeps coming back to, is what are we talking about? Are we talking about a human being or aren't we? And, you know, the question of development, you have to provide a premise upon which development even matters. Because, you know, unless we're going to start going full-blown eugenics and saying we need, you know, like the Nazis did, and saying we need to start executing people who fail to meet certain standards or who have developmental disabilities or whatever the case may be, development has never been a rationale or a justification for murder. TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. Whenever somebody dies young, it's widely regarded as a particularly noteworthy tragedy. Somebody dies, you know, especially a child, a teenager, you know, somebody who's particularly young. If they meet an untimely end, we feel worse than if we hear news about somebody who lives to a ripe old age, finally passing away. Why is that? Why do we feel as though it's some sort of grander tragedy for a young person to die than an old person to die? Because it occurs to me, you know, we've been reflecting upon the conversation we had earlier this week on Tuesday with Pastor Nathan Roberts and Nurse Lori Egan regarding abortion. And it occurs to me, if the developmental argument that's brought to bear by advocates of abortion has merit, if it's correct, that argument being essentially that your developmental status grants you moral worth. You know, if you haven't arrived at this place of quote viability in the womb at 20 to 24 weeks or whatever arbitrary point we've decided that viability occurs, then you are not a human being. You shouldn't be afforded rights. We shouldn't even think of you in terms of being a person who ought to be considered in the question of whether or not the pregnancy should be brought to term. If that is a morally correct premise, then that premise would play out throughout the entire course of a human lifespan. So in fact, our reaction to death would be inverted. You know, the young person who dies, child, teenager, the young person who dies would be like, oh, well, you know, no big deal. They weren't as developed as a full-grown adult human being. So why should we care? And we would be much more concerned and deeply affected and hurt by a ripe old age, an elderly person at a ripe old age passing away. We'd be like, oh, what a fully developed person who had a long, meaningful, impactful life. It's such a tragedy that they died, so much more so than if it was a seven-year-old who hasn't contributed anything, right? And yet that's not how we think about death, is it? Just a curious little observation on my part here tonight on a Freestyle Friday / Thursday. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. Streaming at TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com and your iHeartRadio app. We are here 8 to 10 weeknights. Appreciate having you with us. You can join the conversation, 651-989-5855. Feel free to steer it in any direction you see fit. Brianne taking those calls and producing the show. I tripped upon a piece during one of the breaks here from humanprogress.org. It's an interesting examination of the question of how wealthy we are compared to people from the past. And, you know, it's measured in, if you actually measure it in terms of the lifestyle of capacity to do things, that people today are more well off than John D. Rockefeller was in 1916, over 100 years ago. The Atlantic recently came out with a portrait of American life a century ago. It is not a pretty picture. Gruelingly long work hours, cramped living spaces, terrible food, child labor, meager technology, and just about everything cost more. This inspired economist Don Berdow to write a blog post asking, how much money would it take for you to agree to live out your life a century ago? Would you do it for $1 million? What about $1 billion? When considering this question, he asks that you keep in mind that in 1916, no matter how rich you were, no matter how much money you had, you would not be able to enjoy any of the following. Radio. Kind of apropos to this audience. Television. Timely transportation. Computers. Air conditioning. Now, that's not something we're particularly have top of mind this time of year, but, you know, give it a few months. You'll be glad you have air conditioning. Rock and roll. International food. Like, you know, being able to get Chinese food, right? And that was not a given 100 years ago. Smartphones. A high likelihood of surviving infancy. I like that one. Contact lenses. I like having that option. Switching between the glasses and the contacts. Modern birth control. You know, if you don't want to have 13 kids, you don't have to. Antibiotics. Accurate watches. Like, down to the microsecond nowadays. I mean, everything's linked. Everything's linked to the atomic clock via the internet. It's fantastic. Skype. Effective dental care. And, of course, the internet. And many other things as well. If you're a woman or any kind of minority, then you would also have to sacrifice various freedoms and live in a world of far worse intolerance. Boudreaux concludes with this observation. He says, honestly, I wouldn't be remotely tempted to quit the 2016 me so that I could be $1 billion richer in 1916. This fact means that by 1916 standards, I am today more than a billionaire. It means, at least given my preferences, I am today materially richer than was John D. Rockefeller in 1916. And that is true. That's true of all of us. And this is the reality, the economic reality and the moral reality that the left completely fails to acknowledge. In their continual quest for equity and their concern about income inequality as if that matters at all. Like, that's another premise, that income inequality is bad. That notion is just accepted without any sort of explanation or argument whatsoever. Explain to me how it's bad. Why is it bad? By what moral premise is somebody else having more income than me bad? Or me having more income than somebody else? Can you explain that? Now, if you want to talk about how somebody gets their money, then we're on to something, right? Like, if the way somebody is obtaining their income is illegitimate, if they're clubbing people over the head, if they're robbing banks, if they're mugging people, if they're running an extortion scam, then yes, that's a problem. But that doesn't have anything to do with the inequality. That has something to do with the inequality of income, and that has something to do with an inequality of rights. As long as everybody has the same legal rights, then an inequality of income shouldn't be a blip on our radar. And, you know, what capitalism has allowed, what income inequality, because I think let's treat as interchangeable income inequality with capitalism, because income inequality is an inevitable outcome of capitalism. We're going to talk about this next Tuesday when we have Pastor Nathan Roberts on again. We're going to talk about the morality of economics. And he's recruiting, I saw online, he's recruiting some left-wing economist to come in here and bash me over the head. So that'll be fun. But this notion that income inequality is bad. Income inequality is the reason why we have all these things that are listed in this article. Televisions, timely transportation, computers, air conditioning, contact lenses. The capacity for somebody to innovate, to invent, to produce, to take action in order to produce a value that is of service to the world at large and then to grow rich as a result by trading value for value. That's why we are able to enjoy the quality of life that we do. So God bless income inequality. Bring on income inequality. I would hate, I and you and any leftist would hate to live in a world where there was no income inequality. And if you doubt me, take a little trip to Venezuela. Because, you know, on the whole, there's some exceptions. There's like a huge spike. The income inequality curve is pretty dramatic down there in Venezuela. There's a few people who have a whole lot. But the vast majority of people are pretty equal in that they have nothing. And by the way, that's true of human history as well. Looking at the wide swath of human beings as a whole, as a genetic family going back to the beginning of time, we are on the tippy top right now. You, no matter what condition you find yourself in, if you're within the broadcast range of this transmission, you are among the richest human beings, materially speaking, the richest human beings that have ever existed on the planet ever. You are in the 1% cosmically. Congratulations. I hope you appreciate it, because you should. And thank a capitalist and become a capitalist. Your children will be able to enjoy the same benefits. Let's talk to Eric in Chanhassen. Welcome to the program.
Hey, Walt. How you doing?
Doing all right.
Hey, I had a question. So I've been hearing, you know, some of the podcasts and stuff I listen to. I've seen some religious broadcasters and stuff say, why is California and Colorado, for instance, allowed to violate federal law on immigration, on marijuana use and things like that? But if we were to have, say, Oklahoma, who is trying to press an abolition of abortion bill to their Senate floor right now, if they were to pass that, they would somehow be required still by the federal government to, you know, not be able to ban abortion in their state. It seems to me that we have states picking and choosing which federal laws they want to obey. You know, why can't a state now say, well, if California is violating federal law on marijuana and immigration law, then why can't we ban abortion? And I'll hang up and listen to your response on the radio.
I appreciate the call, Eric, and you ask a fantastic question, and I think the premise is entirely legitimate. And I know our next caller will agree. Zach from Llano Lakes, you've been saying for quite some time that states ought to ignore the Supreme Court and ignore federal law and just move forward with banning abortion.
Indeed. And the thing is, like, it's kind of to conservative shame that we're not doing this as fast as they are, that they're doing it before us. And the problem is, like, I think too often we just react to the left because the left is doing that. A good article that might be worth looking at this weekend is Avoiding the Evangelical Reactionary Surrender by John Reasoner in the American Vision, that Reconstructionist website that I always bring up. I mean, you brought up the point about, you know, abortion and, you know, why is it that we feel it's a greater tragedy when
a young person dies?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's like, it's the left talks about, you know, standing up for the weaker among us and stuff. And, you know, we can see right through it as conservatives, you know,
right,
when we see them defending injustices like abortion.
Mm-hmm.
But oftentimes when a liberal points out something that's unjust, we automatically react to what they say because it's a leftist saying that.
Right.
And unfortunately, like, in many cases, the thing that they point out is really a condemnation of their worldview. Like, when they condemn the way police get a double standard, for instance, if you're coming at it from a conservative perspective, hey, somebody who works for the government shouldn't be held to a different standard than somebody who is a private citizen. That's something that a conservative, using their foundation that they claim to hold to, that's something we should latch on to. And going back to the abortion thing, I mean, why is it that a child is considered more valuable and more worth protecting, I guess, is what I'm trying to say, not more valuable? Well, I mean, could we be consistent here? I mean, racial minorities, they are more vulnerable to oppression. The poor are more vulnerable to oppression, but I see a lot of reaction out there because, the only people who are pointing out racism or pointing out this sort of thing are liberals, unfortunately. And unfortunately, it's gotten so bad that justice, the word justice, is often seen as a tenet of the left. You know, it's so easy for us to be so caught up in attacking the left that we just want to beat them over the head, and so that's why I've said before, and I'll say again, the reactionary right has this tendency to be so afraid of anything that looks liberal that sometimes I feel like they resort to outright socialism in order to fight the left.
Well, I'll agree with you there. I appreciate the call as always, Zach. It's been a recurring theme of the program, and will be, no doubt, indefinitely, until they kick me off the air, that conservatives' fatal flaw and the reason why we continue to fail and lose elections and lose legislative battles and watches our culture and our society and our public policy are dragged further and further leftward, the reason why is exactly because of what Zach articulates. It's because we're reactive. It's because we put our hands up and try to stop the juggernaut from moving any farther. And when we manage to slow it down a little bit, we congratulate ourselves and go back to life as usual, as if we've actually achieved something meaningful and lasting, and then, you know, wait for the next thing to trigger us to react once again. That's not going to cut it. We need to be proactive. We need to be for something. We need to be advancing the real concept of justice and displace the fake moral premises of the left. 651-989-5855. Closing argument. My name's Walter Atson, Twin Cities News Talk.
1035 FM.
I'm pretty sure that the last time I watched the Oscars, like actually sat down and conscientiously on purpose watched the Oscars, I was probably a minor. Like, I was probably in my parents' house watching it on a tube television. I have had no interest whatsoever. Now, I'm a movie fan. I like movies. You know, before I had kids, I probably went to go see 4 or 5 movies a month. And I've always enjoyed, I still follow movie news. You know, my wife and I try to catch up on movies at home whenever we have the time, which isn't too terribly often. But I am. I'm a movie fan, but I have no interest whatsoever in the award shows. Just not at all. Now, the Oscars do have some merit, just in terms of the types of awards that are provided or offered out there for entertainment. The Oscars do actually abide by a process that has a degree of legitimacy above and beyond, say, like the MTV Movie Awards or something along those lines. Like, there's actually like a process in place that has some merit to it. So, you know, I'll look at the list after the fact of things that won awards and kind of use that to guide my choices of, you know, what I'm going to might take a look at throughout the rest of the year. But I have no interest in sitting there and watching as it happened. So I was surprised, as I was prepping for the show tonight, to read about Spike Lee, who apparently threw a huge fit when his movie, Black Klansman, which looks like a good movie, by the way, I'm actually interested in checking this out. His movie, Black Klansman, did not win Best Picture. And like the child that he is, he threw a temper tantrum. From the Daily Wire, he said, "I'm snake bit. Every time someone's driving somebody, I lose," Spike Lee told reporters. I have no idea what that means.
It's a reference to Driving Miss Daisy. So it feels it's kind of like in the same vein.
Okay, yeah,
kind of
because
whitewash.
Right.
That's kind of his beef, I guess.
I gotcha. Because the movie that did win is this Green Book, which I also have not seen, that had Viggo Mortensen and I can't remember the name of the other guy.
Mahershala Ali,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah. Who's great, by the way. Fantastic guy. He's so good. I remember the first time I ever saw him was in that old show, The 4400. It's if you get a chance to check out 4400, watch it. Like, it's one of those shows that doesn't have a satisfying conclusion, so just resolve yourself to that. but he's fantastic and he's a great actor. At any rate, so yeah, it's a that my understanding of Green Book is that it's a movie about, it takes place in like the 50s or something like that, and it's a movie about a relationship between a racist white guy, played by Viggo Mortensen, and a black, I believe he's a pianist, played by Mahershala Ali, and how they basically end up becoming friends, and you know, despite the racial differences, which, you know, there was a time when that type of a narrative was considered inspiring and uplifting and hopeful. Now it's part of the patriarchy, apparently. Now it's part of the white...
Problematic, I think, is the word they use.
Now it's part of the white supremacy. So Spike Lee throws a fit, right, when he doesn't win an award. And it goes on here to say, Green Book is a Band-Aid film. This is the commentary from The Hollywood Reporter, Spike Lee's Righteous Anger, as reported by Richard Newby. He describes Green Book as a Band-Aid film covering up an open wound in need of stitches, while Lee's Black Klansman forces us to look closely at America's racial wound and provides a means through which we can begin to heal it. Through recognizing that there's no easy fix and the wound will still leave a scar on our country's history, Green Book is a step back for the Academy Awards and a reminder that despite our ability to be honored as winners, black stories still make us outsiders. Until the institutions in place are changed, metaphorically burned down with our righteous anger, will remain so. So, just to review, you can be a millionaire black director going to a black tie gala in Hollywood, California, and you are still a victim of the white supremacy. It is astounding. It is astounding.
I mean, you'd say he's probably one of the most celebrated black directors.
Yeah, no, and
too,
look,
right?
I Malcolm X is one of those movies with Denzel Washington. It's, for me, it's kind of up there with like Goodfellas, where if it's on, I'll sit down and watch it, right? And I've watched it multiple times, and it's incredibly fast. Spike Lee's a good director. That doesn't mean he's not stupid. That doesn't mean he's not an idiot, right? Okay, like Jennifer Lawrence. There's an article that I had in the stack.
Agreed.
Jennifer Lawrence is an amazing actress. Like, she is truly gifted. Her talent is unbelievable. Dumb as a box of rocks. Just an idiot when it comes to anything other than acting. But whatever. It doesn't mean I'm not going to go see her movies. But I don't have to. I don't have to grant her some sort of legitimacy outside the realm of her industry. You know, it's kind of the same thing here with Spike Lee. The thing that I found noteworthy about this, above and beyond what I've already said, is that it's isn't it fascinating that Spike Lee and Samuel L. Jackson is also cited in this, and you know, this guy writing at The Hollywood Reporter, that they don't even attempt to argue that Black Klansman should have won because it's the better movie. They don't even attempt to make that argument. Now, the category is Best Picture, right? Like, the whole point of the Oscars is to recognize excellent achievement, outstanding achievement in motion picture production. The Best Picture category is meant to recognize what the industry sees as the best film overall, all things considered, of the year. They don't even attempt to make the argument that Black Klansman fits that bill. Their argument is it's more important to the revolution. It's more important to our social cause. And it would serve social justice for us to get this award, therefore we should get it. This is the Hollywood manifestation of basically affirmative action, right? That forget about merit, forget about productivity, forget about actual value. The black guy should get it because he's black. That's basically the argument. The black guy should get it because he's black, which, incidentally, is racist in and of itself. 651-989-5855. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk. AM 1130, 103.5 FM, Twin Cities News Talk.
And 103.5 FM.
I've been sitting here thinking, how can I talk about these next two stories without getting myself in trouble? And I think I just need to resolve myself to the inevitability that there's just no way to do it. Like, you know, we're diving into some territory here that is just landmines in today's culture. You know, because here's what we're going to talk about. I got two pieces. The first one is about a dating website that specializes in connecting Western men with Slavic women. And the reason why is because Slavic women are apparently well known for being traditional and fulfilling traditional roles, for dressing well and keeping a good house and cooking meals. So that's story number one. You can see the landmines that are all replete around that one. Story number two from the Daily Wire, Michael Knowles puts forward a proposal for President Donald Trump, suggesting how he can crack the left's gender ideology. And the proposal that he has is quite provocative and hilarious and replete with all kinds of cultural hazards. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. Streaming at TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com and your iHeartRadio app. We are here 8 to 10 weeknights. Appreciate you joining us. You can contribute 651-989-5855. Breanne taking those calls and producing the show. Appreciate her being here. All right, so let's get into this first piece. This is from a place called MindAlyzed.com. Not my first source for news. I've never seen this website before in my life. But nonetheless, the content here is fascinating. We live in times where traditional values are becoming a thing of the past, and the line between the division of responsibilities in a relationship is unclear. No longer do women take on the role of cooking and keeping the house. Statistics show that a staggering percentage of women under 29 in countries such as the United States, Australia, and the United Kingdom don't even know how to prepare a hot meal, having their primary focus on their career. But just because the women in these countries are changing doesn't mean that all men are adjusting. There are still plenty of men in Western countries who are looking for a partner with traditional values. This is when they start to look outside the box, or in this case, outside the country. We've recently caught up with Albina, the founder of Rondi.com, a platform which connects Western men with attractive young Slavic women. The platform is free to use, but the reason why it attracts so many young women is that the men are required to complete a short questionnaire to ensure they are serious about starting a relationship, which protects the women from immature individuals looking for a short-lived hookup. Albina has agreed to share some of the insights as to why this intercontinental trend is on the rise, and the motives on both sides, the men and the women, because it isn't just the men who are looking. Slavic women who are registered on her website are also strongly driven to start a life with Western men. Why? Let's find out. So let's skip down here to the case for why Western men are going for Slavic women. She offers, the founder of this website, four categories, four bullet points, so to speak, in terms of what Slavic women have to offer to Western male potentials. The first, number one, and this is truly controversial, beauty. Yes, Slavic beauty is undeniable. The body shapes and facial features of Eastern European beauties are different from those of Western women. They are naturally very attractive, but they also know how to take care of themselves and how to emphasize their natural beauty with skincare routines they learned from their mothers. As a result, many of them use very little makeup. They enjoy wearing heels and flowing summer dresses that show their slender shapes. Slavic women select their clothes carefully when they leave the house, and it's not just for special occasions. It's an ingrained sense of pride to always look their best, even when it's just to get groceries from the local shop. Boy, oh boy, oh boy. I feel like I've done something wrong by quoting this, right? The number two on the list of features: femininity. Many men on Rondi.com complain that Western women have lost their femininity. Most of them value comfort over nice appearance. They cringe at the horrible trend of Western women wearing active wear on a constant basis and almost everywhere they go, whereas Slavic ladies celebrate their femininity by dressing up on a daily basis. Western women seldom get dressed up, the exception being some special occasions. If you're tired of women obsessed with feminist ideas, dressed in clothes only suitable for young male teenagers. You should definitely give meeting a Slavic woman a try and see how feminine women can be. Slavic women are aware that they are women and don't try to hide the feminine charm nature has blessed them with. They go into intelligence. I'll skip that one for now. And this last one, though, really stands out. Loyalty is a feature of Slavic women, according to this website. You should try your hand at chatting with Slavic women on Roddy.com because one of them may just be the woman of your dreams. Slavic women are loyal and very giving when they truly love their man. They will support him and stay by his side through thick and thin, sharing his joys and sorrows. Blind love is an appropriate way to describe the love of a Slavic woman. She will always side with her spouse no matter what others say about him. She'll be his loyal friend and always be there when he needs her counsel or shoulder to cry on. Now, what about the other side of this transaction? Why are such attractive, smart women looking for Western men? Well, three reasons are offered. Number one, they believe that Western men take better care of their women. Slavic girls seeking men abroad believe that Westerners treat women better than men from their home country. Western guys are happy to give their ladies compliments or gifts. Men from Ukraine usually only show such attention at the start of a relationship. This quickly deteriorates as soon as the relationship gets more serious. Number two, they dislike Slavic men's mentality. Western men are used to taking care of their appearance, but in Eastern European countries, the word metrosexual is considered insulting. Slavic men don't pay enough attention to hygiene and rarely have a sense of style, but that doesn't stop them from wanting to have beauties by their side. Westerners, on the other hand, are willing to invest in themselves and their women in order to allow her to take care of herself so that she can always look her best. And number three, and I think this is probably one of the more prominent reasons, they desire a better standard of living. Most Slavic men find it hard to make enough money to cover basic needs, let alone what is considered a standard by Western norms. Therefore, women often have to worry about money and sometimes have to support the men they have a relationship with. They dream of a life where they could have someone to rely on, someone to take care of those needs. Now, the reason why I found this article and this development provocative is because it's interesting that, you know, if this website, if this is more than just marketing, if this is indicative of an actual phenomenon that's taking place where Eastern European women are seeking Western men and vice versa for these reasons that are listed, it's fascinating that you have these parallel cultures wherein respective genders are deviating from traditional norms while the opposite gender in those same countries is clinging to them. And isn't that true of here in the United States for the most part? I mean, you know, granted, the lofty idealistic description of Western men here certainly doesn't apply to me, doesn't apply to a lot of men that I know. And I'm sure that there are plenty of Slavic women who don't meet the standard that's put forward by the heading above of how wonderful Slavic women are. But be that as it may, generally speaking, men in the United States of America, men in the West, continue to aspire toward success, abundance, career success, being able to provide. They see themselves as protectors and providers and doers, and you know they take charge of chores around the house and being handymen and what have you. And there is no movement for men to abandon those norms. Certainly not to the degree that modern Western feminism has encouraged women to abandon the traditional norms that were ascribed to their gender in the past. And apparently the exact opposite is happening in Eastern Europe, where men are less and less like traditional men, and the women are not. And so you have this weird cross-cultural, cross-continental dating service that has developed as a result. And to me, you know, it just signals the fact that there is and we talked a little bit about this on Tuesday in the context of abortion, which, you know, may not seem like a very natural topic in which something like this would be associated with. But we find ourselves trying to reinvent the wheel culturally all the time, where the left will argue that, well, we should do away with tradition. We should do away with marriage. We should do away with the family as it's traditionally understood. And we should substitute new definitions and new approaches to what the domestic life should look like. And then when that results in entirely predictable breakdowns in social order and all sorts of the development of all sorts of social problems, you know, single motherhood, rises in STDs, it rises in abortions, we find ourselves scratching our heads going, gee, how do we solve this problem? You know, and this was actually said, Lori actually went in this direction on Tuesday night. You know, if we could come up with some sort of social contract by which it was understood that people, before they have children, are going to take mutual responsibility for caring for them, then perhaps we would be able to get around some of these problems. Yeah, we have that. It's called marriage. So you're reinventing the wheel. And in a similar sense, that's what they're doing here with this Slavic/Western dating website, is it's two segments of different cultures that are having to come together to reinvent the wheel because the other gender in their respective home countries has dropped the ball. TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com.
103.5 FM.
So as we close the show this evening for the week, tomorrow night you'll have your Golden Gophers hockey. I want to turn your attention to this piece from the Daily Wire from Michael Knowles. I believe this is a transcript from his podcast. He has an idea as to how Donald Trump could, as he puts it, crack the left's gender ideology. And I'm just going to read this because I can't do it any further justice. He writes, "I think I figured out the only way to crack up the left's ridiculous gender ideology. All these stupid pronoun battles in the bathrooms and all that. Before Trump leaves office, for just one day, President Trump needs to identify as a woman. Donna Trump. For one day. There are only two possible consequences of this. Either the left will have to admit the absurdity of gender ideology and transgenderism, or the left will have to celebrate Donald Trump as the first woman president." Beat Hillary to it. Beat Amy Klobuchar. Beat Kamala Harris. Beat Liz Warren. Donna Trump. That's what we'll call him for that one day. Donna Trump will become the first woman president. If he remains married to Melania, he will be the first gay president. Not just the first gay president, the first lesbian president. Not just the first lesbian president, the first gay married lesbian president married to an immigrant. It will be a glorious moment. Now you could say, that's okay, that's a funny line, whatever. But first of all, if any president were going to do this, it would be Donald Trump, the greatest troll ever to occupy the office. But why wouldn't he do it? Let's say he does it. Obviously he has, I'm a woman today. I have to issue an executive proclamation. I'm a woman, I will go by Donna. What's the left going to do? They're going to say, no, you're not. Yeah, well, he could say, how dare you? How dare you assume my gender? Et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, we can all tell how this would play out. And it's quite a brilliant idea, actually. Now, I actually wouldn't put this past Trump. Like, I think he's entirely capable of pulling this off. And it would be fascinating to hear the responses and to consider the reactions. Because how did they argue against this? I don't even think I can anticipate it. Even having had the conversation here in this studio with Pastor Nathan Roberts and another one of our guests, I'm not sure how they would be able to counter this type of a claim. Because the entire basis of transgenderism is, if I say I am, then I am, right? Like, if I claim it, it's mine. And you don't get to challenge it. You don't get to say otherwise. Biology is not determinative. The will is. My feelings are. So how do you argue against somebody saying, well, for today I'm going to be a woman and tomorrow I'll go back to being a man? I do not know. From the Star Tribune, dozens of community and nonprofit theaters across the U.S. have been forced to abandon productions of To Kill a Mockingbird under legal threat by Broadway and Hollywood producer Scott Rudin. The combative move has prompted calls for a boycott of Rudin's work. Rudin is arguing that author Harper Lee signed over to him exclusive worldwide rights to the title of the novel, and that Rudin's current adaptation on Broadway, written by Aaron Sorkin, is the only version allowed to be performed. That means different adaptations have had to be scuttled in such small venues as the Grand Theater in Salt Lake City, Mugford Street Players in Marblehead, Massachusetts, and Karvonosky Theater in Buffalo, New York, as well as a planned United Kingdom and Ireland tour. They had licensed rights for a different version written by Christopher Sergel and licensed by the Dramatic Publishing Company, or DPC. In a statement, Rudin defended his position, saying, "We hate to ask anybody to cancel any production of a play anywhere, but the production in question is licensed by BDP, infringes on rights licensed to us by Harper Lee directly," he said. Now, without getting into the intricacies of all this, this is the fascinating aspect here is that you're dealing with an industry that lives and dies according to copyright, right? Like the entertainment industry as a whole only exists and is only to proceed profitably because we have protection of intellectual property encoded in law. And yet when it becomes inconvenient, and in this case, they try to cite, you know, social justice, and they rely heavily on arguing that, oh, these are small theaters and they're being victimized by a big, bad Broadway star. You know, they're eating their own here. And, you know, if they were to apply the principle equally, they would undermine their entire industry and nobody would be able to have a theater for very long. But, you know, suffice it to say, the left is very good at killing the goose that laid the golden egg. TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com.